Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with producer Jason DeFilippo. On the Jordan Harbinger Show, we decode the stories, secrets, and skills of the world's most brilliant and interesting people and turn their wisdom into practical advice that you can use to impact your own life and those around you. I want to help you see the matrix when it comes to how these amazing people think and behave. I want you to become a better thinker. That's what strengthens your life, your career, your business, your family, the democracy we live in. If you're new to the show, we've got episodes with spies and CEOs, athletes and authors, thinkers and performers, as well as toolboxes for skills like negotiation, public speaking, body language, persuasion, and more. So if you're smart and you like to learn and improve, then you're going to be right at home here with us. On this episode of the show, Simon Sinek. This guy's just a force. You've seen him everywhere, on the TED stage, ranting about millennials or consulting some of the top companies in the world on business, strategy, and spitting fire about fulfillment and culture in the workplace. Today, Simon Sinek like you've never heard him before. We really cut loose on this one and broke the mold of leadership and corporate topics, diving deep into subjects like trust, focus, branding, and the way that we look at our careers and our business as an extension of ourselves. If you don't have a business, this will still apply to your career. If you don't have a career, we'll figure it out. If you're a Simon Sinek fan, and even if you're not, I know you're going to dig this one. And if you want to know how I managed to book all these great people and have people like Simon Sinek, well, it's about systems, it's about tiny habits, and it's about making and maintaining relationships in a way that's not, frankly, awkward, weird, and needy. I'm teaching you how to do that for free. That's at 6-Minute Networking. It's a free course over at jordanharbinger.com/course. And by the way, most of the guests on the show, they subscribe to the course and the newsletter. Come join us. You'll be in great company. Now, here's Simon Sinek. At some point, every speaker writes a lot of books. I don't know if you consider yourself a speaker, an author, more, or both. Or is it like thought leader, some sort of nebulous third category?
Oh my God, I would never call myself that.
Good, okay. That's a...
I prefer guru.
Guru, yes. Yes, guru. Like Bikram from the yoga thing, or that guy who founded a city.
I think I love that when people call themselves guru in their own bios. It's like, I think the whole point of being a guru is you actually don't call yourself a guru.
Yeah.
No, I consider myself an optimist. I believe that I have a vision of the world that does not yet exist, and I'm trying to build it. And whatever it takes for me to advance that vision, speaking, writing, teaching, whatever it is, I'll do it. So I don't define myself by anything that I do.
By the medium?
No, I define myself by who I am and where I'm going.
Yeah. I spent years doing that, though. Like, it's easy, and people go, you're a podcaster, and it's like, well, that sounds really lame. But it's also kind of true, just as you're an author, but it's not all that you are. Right?
No, it's one thing that I do, and it's one thing that I do by accident. You know, I didn't plan on being an author. I wasn't one of those guys who's like, I've got a book in me, you know?
Oh, really?
No, never.
I'm surprised to hear that.
It wasn't an aspiration from youth or anything like that. I had an idea, and somebody thought I needed to write it down, and so I did.
Yeah, I heard, I can't remember who told me this, it was like, oh yeah, she discovered Simon Sinek, and I was like, I wonder if he would agree with that. I can't remember who it was, though, so this story kind of falls on its face. Or the anecdote.
Who was it?
If I remember, I will send you an email because I can't. It wasn't something I was planning.
There are many people who gave me breaks.
Sure.
I don't think there was any one.
It was somebody who basically had said, this guy's got to go to TED. And like, but this is someone else's version of events too, right? So if, it may or may not have happened that way.
I don't know. I mean, I was given the opportunity to speak at a TEDx. I'm very grateful for it. And the TEDx video became the highest watched TEDx video on YouTube, which is, I think, what it caught the attraction of the TED people. At least that's how I understand it.
So you didn't start off at TED?
No, I only talked at TED on the main stage a few years ago for the first time.
Really? That's shocking.
It's a TEDx. And I love it because, you know, people, especially, you know, TED can make a career. I mean, I'm living proof of it, you know? Mm-hmm. It can be a catalyst for a career in a major way. And so when people go on and do a TED or a TEDx, you know, you can feel that the tension is palpable because they think it's a make or break. And they want it to be perfect, and they have everything rehearsed and everything. And I'm living proof that I have terrible video quality, you know, terrible audio quality. My microphone broke at the beginning of the talk. I've got a pad and pen and no PowerPoint. And it became, at one point, it was the second most watched TED Talk of all time. And my point is like, if you have good content, you have good content.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's rough and tumble. It doesn't matter if the sound quality is imperfect. You know, people want ideas. It's nice if it works out nicely, but it's not essential.
That's such a lucky break in so many ways. And I don't mean that you didn't earn it. What I mean is, how great is it to go up there and go, it's just a TEDx. I'll be fine. Oh, the mic broke. Whatever. It doesn't really matter. And then that blows up. Not, okay, I prepared for this for 90 days. I've been rehearsing 8 hours a day. It cost me $60,000 for a speaking coach full time.
then you're 5 minutes late or something, or the event's a little off, or the microphone's glitching out, and you're freaking out, right?
I think what made it work was that I didn't freak out. I mean, they literally replaced my mic in the middle of my talk, where I'm using a wireless mic, which the signal is getting interrupted.
Yeah.
And somebody comes up and hands me a wired mic in the middle. And you don't hear me go, or hold on, ladies and gentlemen, or, oh, this mic's not working. I'm in the middle of a sentence, and I take the new mic, and I just keep talking. And I think that's one of the reasons it works, is my mind is really focused on spreading the message, and I'm not getting stuck in the mind trap of, oh my God, this is going horribly wrong. Oh my God, what am I going to do? And so you just in stride. I gave a talk once where the fire alarm went off in the middle of my talk, and we all stopped. And we're like, what?
You're not going anywhere, ladies and gentlemen. This is important.
Exactly. And then, I stopped.
Well, yeah.
We figured out what happened. And then I started again. I see it on the stage a lot, where I see the speaker complaining about something or talking about something or interrupting because what's bothering them, they think is bothering the audience.
Right.
And it's just not true.
Right. Nobody knows.
What bothers us on the stage really doesn't bother the audience. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, really sorry I have a cold. Nobody really cares.
Right.
They can hear that you have a cold.
Right. Yeah. Oh, we just thought you were a nerd with a nasal voice.
They can hear that you're sniffling and that your sinuses are clogged. They can hear it. So I think that's one of the big tricks of being, an effective public speaker, which is the audience is rooting for you. They always are. And they're pretty forgiving. And the more that you point out the stuff that's wrong, the more it's going to go bad.
Sure.
The message is what matters. That's why the people are there. And I understand you want perfection, but sometimes that's out of your control.
Sure.
And I think that's part of what makes the really effective ones, like I guess I've seen it on stage before, the really good ones are the ones that just, it's really about the message and not about them.
People have said the TED Talks, they're so well rehearsed that even the little gestures that look like they're off the cuff are rehearsed. I know every speaker is different, but what do you think about that? Do you think a lot of these people are just really good speakers, or they're so well rehearsed that even them looking to the left casually is part of their blocking?
Depends on the speaker.
Yeah.
Depends on the speaker. I mean, some speakers do actually rehearse every gesture, every joke, And TED is a very buttoned up operation, especially for people who don't do it professionally, where they do rehearse them like crazy. Mm-hmm. And so there's a few videos out there. I can't remember, one of the late night talk shows made a joke about giving a TED talk, and sort of they take, it's Jesus giving a TED talk, And it has all the tropes in it, and it's uncomfortably accurate.
Yeah.
It's very funny. But yeah, I mean, some of it is a little canned, but it depends on the speaker. Some speakers are more casual. Ken Robinson, who has the number one TED Talk of all time and has forever, and we all worship Ken. I mean, he's as good as it gets. Everything's real. It's all on camera. It's just how he is. It's magical to watch him.
When you get sort of elevated to this plane where you're like straight into the pros, mm-hmm. not that you had nothing to do with that before, but like to jump to that stage, there's got to be a little bit of, does self-doubt creep in at all? Are you like, oh crap, how the hell am I going to compete with Ken Robinson? Or, well, I hope this goes as well as my first talk did. I mean, it seems like you're competing with yourself, you're competing with other people at the top of the game. It's a little bit nervous.
I mean, I'm not competing with Ken Robinson. I'm amazed that I get to be in the same grouping as Ken Robinson. Mm-hmm. I think there's an intense gratitude that I get to share the stage with these remarkable human beings who mm-hmm. I adore. And some of them I've gotten to know personally, and I love their work, and it's a treat for me to hear them, and to be included in that group it's an honor. So that's a real treat.
What about pressure from your own work going, okay, well, I mean,
how am I going to do? Well, yeah. when I got the opportunity to do the main TED stage, mm-hmm. people were like, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
I was like, first of all, I won the internet lottery. I didn't plan on the Start With Why talk going viral, but mm-hmm. like that wasn't like, yep, check, did that. This is why I met somebody recently at a dinner, and I asked him what he does. He says, I make viral videos. I'm like, no, you don't. You make videos, and you hope they go viral.
You like, freaking
pray. This is the whole point of a viral video. Nobody really knows how to make them.
Yeah.
You can do videos that do okay, mm-hmm. but I don't think any videos that have truly gone viral, it wasn't machined that way.
Sure.
So when I had the opportunity to do another TED Talk, I was under no illusions that it was going to do as well as the first. When people said, how are you going to do better than the first? The answer was, I'm not. Like, are you insane?
It's
like, you go and do one better. It was number two. You go ahead. You go be number one.
It's sure,
like, you can't plan that stuff.
Right.
And so I had no pressure on me to outdo, like I said, I won the lottery. I can't win the lottery again. And so what I did when I showed up for a future TED Talks is I showed up to do the best job I could do and communicate the message that I was trying to communicate as clearly as possible for that message.
Yeah.
And let the chips fall where they may, I compete with myself in the sense that I'm trying to outdo. It's not a question of outdoing. I want to hone my craft. I love feedback. I love honest feedback even more. And I want to get better at what I do. I think that's not unusual. I think a lot of people have that.
Sure.
Any of us who show up on a daily basis, you go and listen to your own podcasts and you know, you might beat yourself up a little bit, but the opportunity is, okay, next time I'm going to do this differently. I'm going to do this better. You become more relaxed. You become more comfortable. You develop a style.
It is a little painful, though. Like, I assume you watch your own talks and mm-hmm. you give yourself...
Some of them.
Some of them, yeah. Not everything. You couldn't possibly watch
it. I do the ones that are different. I like to watch the ones that I took a risk or did something new. Those are the ones I go watch.
You hear about guys like David Letterman, who you brought up earlier, watching every show after they do the show, like can't go to bed before they watch it. And by all accounts, he would shred himself mm-hmm. mercilessly to the point where people around him were like, hey man, calm down. Mm-hmm. You know, he's making himself like actively miserable doing it. There's got to be a happy medium there. Do you find?
Look, it depends on the style of the person. You know, these folks are at the top of their game because they're very, very hypercritical of themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the highest performers I know are very hypercritical of themselves. More hypocritical of themselves than they are of other people, or other people can be of them. I'm probably my own worst critic for sure, and I notice little things that probably other people miss. Mm-hmm. You know, I think anybody who's satisfied with the job that they're doing isn't growing. I mean, I definitely have things that I do where I walk away and I'm like, that was good. Like, I know when it's good, mm-hmm. but I also know when I could do better.
I think the reason I ask so many questions about this process is because looking from the outside in, right, people go, well, Simon Sinek, every book that you stamp is going to kill it. Every talk you give is going to kill it. You do a show like Impact Theory, rant about millennials, possibly unplanned, and then that just takes off and gets, I don't know, 18 million views or something like that.
It got 80 in the first week.
In the first week.
It's insane. I mean,
all you got to do is complain about people 35 and under, and you're just, you know, that's the new formula.
Well, I wasn't complaining, but yeah, point well taken.
Right. Well, obviously, I'm exaggerating for lame comedic effect. But like that
it's working, I'm laughing.
Pops off. Yeah, that thing pops off, and then it's like, this guy can't screw anything up. At what point do you go...
hang out with me for a while.
Right. Well, that's why I'm asking, right? Because someone came over to my house, Neil Pasricha, who I think you probably know or maybe know of. He came over and he's like, from the outside in, you're doing so great. And I'm thinking, I wish I had a glimpse of what other people, like I want to look at myself like other people maybe do for like 5 minutes a day just to relax for a second. But then there's another part of myself that says, well, being hypercritical and beating myself up all the time is why you're here in the first place. Mm-hmm. This is why you get to go hang out with somebody who's a guru, thought leader, whatever you want to call yourself these days.
Lottery winner,
yeah. Double mic each other, and then just sit here and record, and then like somehow a check arrives in the mail for doing so.
Yeah.
But it also is kind of a recipe for, there's an element of, I don't want to say unhappiness, but there's got to be a part of you that goes, all right, now I'm just torturing myself for this. Like you're flying around giving talks, you love it, but at the same time, don't you want to hang out a little bit more at home, watch a little Netflix? Like, the balance has to be hard.
Well, that's in my control, isn't it?
It is, but also the temptation.
You know, when I overcommit myself, I have only myself to blame. Sure, I've overcommitted myself, and sure, I'm exhausted, and I'm like, and I beat myself up for saying yes to too much stuff because I want to be out there spreading the message. And
yeah.
I sometimes forget that I need to recharge my batteries.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty good. I learned the hard way. You know, the good news is I try not to make mistakes more than once. But I learned, you know, I'm pretty good about blocking off time for me. And if I have a particularly grueling few weeks, I'll purposely take it easy, you know, for a week or two. I think one of the things we can all do, regardless if you have a 9-to-5 job or if you have more control of your own schedule or not, is we can still build in time for ourselves. The thing that I started to do is, because personal time or going to the gym or anything like that started to become flexible. Mm-hmm. You know, someone's like, we need to have a meeting with you. I'm like, oh, okay, I can go to the gym tomorrow.
Oh, that's so mean.
You know?
Yeah.
And what ended up happening is I got out of shape and I wasn't sleeping and things get worse and worse and worse. And so I just became much more prescriptive and much more sort of dogmatic about protecting these blocks in my calendar. So, you know, at the beginning of the week, I'd put in gym time for the next 2 weeks, mm-hmm. and we treated it like a meeting. Mm-hmm. So if somebody called and said, you know, is Simon available? The answer would be, I'm sorry, he's engaged. No, they don't have to know what I'm doing.
Right.
I'm booked.
Yeah.
You know?
He's in downward dog right now.
You know?
He can't
exactly go. Right. And so I started to become more like that's protected time. And every now and then, what I would do is I'd go into my own calendar and block up 2 hours that I wrote, do not schedule anything. And it was just time that I wanted to do whatever I wanted to do, mm-hmm. whether it was watch TV or go for a walk or catch up on some errands and just like take the dry cleaning in kind of thing, you know? It was just time for me to catch up. But I became really, really dogmatic that these times were not to be changed or moved. Of course, there are always exceptions and extenuating circumstances. But for the most part, I'm pretty good about it. And I think we can all do that. you know, and you come home to your family, I think, you know, especially if you have kids and stuff, you know, to actively turn off the telephones for an hour to play with the kids or have dinner with the family, I think is a big deal. If the time for you is 8 to 9 o'clock or 8 to 10 o'clock at night, where, you know, you just want to sit down and watch television and just be like, ugh,
yeah.
You know, to literally put it in a calendar and be like, that's TV time.
Mm-hmm.
That's my TV time. I don't answer emails.
Yeah.
And I became really good at that and less guilty. I felt less guilty about it. You know, I think one of the problems with technology is, I remember when cell phones were just starting to show up in a proper way, you know, smartphones. And
right.
Not like the big,
extending,
yeah, exactly,
yeah.
The big, yes, hello, cell. You know, there was this great promise that we could leave the office because of this device. And in reality, it backfired. We don't leave the office comes with us.
Right.
So we're always at the office, you know, because of the device. And so this is the whole idea sort of backfired. And one of the things that happens when we take the office with us is if we're not constantly engaging and checking in, we actually feel guilty that we're not.
Yeah.
Right?
Of course.
Like, and so what ends up happening is there's no blank time. You know, you're walking to the subway, you're on the device.
Mm-hmm.
If you're off the subway, going to the office, you're on the device. We take the phone with us to the bathroom, you know?
Well, yeah.
We do. You hold it in and look for the phone. You know, that's there's something unhealthy about that.
It's so true.
You know?
It's so true.
And I think when we're not connected, we actually feel guilty. And the reality is that ideas don't happen when we're connected. Ideas happen when our minds have an opportunity to wander. Our conscious brains, our thinking parts of our brains, have access to the equivalent of something like 2 feet of information around us. This is the part of the brain we access when we access our expertise.
Repeat that one more time.
Our thinking brains, have access to the equivalent of information to about 2 feet of information around us.
Oh, I see.
Like a diameter of 2 feet is about how much information the conscious brain can store.
Got it, okay. Right?
And you'll see it's an analogy.
It's coming. I'm with you.
It's coming. This is the part of the brain we access when we weigh the pros and cons, when we think through an idea.
Mm-hmm.
But our subconscious brain has access to the equivalent of 11 acres of information, right? Every conversation we've had, every movie we've seen, every book we've read gets stored somewhere. We just can't recall it. We just can't pull it up when we want to. And this is why we have our great ideas in the shower, when we're driving, when we're out for a run, when we're just going for a walk, because the brainstorming session actually isn't the time to solve the problem. The brainstorming session is the time to ask the question. Your subconscious brain won't solve a problem for something you're not thinking about. It'll attempt to solve something for a problem you're really facing or an idea you really have. It's not going to just start thinking of random things,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so if we don't allow that part of the brain to wander, literally, W-A and W-O,
mm-hmm.
when we go for a wander to allow our brain to wander, we don't have those innovative ideas. And there's a reason for in the shower, on the run, in bed, you know, whenever your ideas strike. It's because you're not actually actively thinking about anything else. And so when I learned about this, it became really important to me. I mean, I'm in the idea business. It became really, really important to me to allow my brain to not think, but to wander. And so I will schedule time specifically not to engage,
mm-hmm.
not to be on my phone. And I think like sitting in a restaurant when a friend goes to the bathroom, not to pick up my phone while I'm waiting, but just to like look around the room is a time to allow my brain to
like
wander.
Like a psychopath, just sitting there, drinking your coffee.
I wouldn't call it a psychopath. I'd call it life before cell phones.
Sure.
You know, for millennia, mm-hmm. we've been looking at the restaurant while our friends are in the bathroom.
Right.
It's only the past 15 years that we haven't been, you know?
Yeah.
Very often, I won't even take a phone with me when I go out, especially when I'm out with friends, because I want to be totally present. But it's actually great for ideas. And so allowing ourselves these disengaged times is absolutely essential for innovation. It's absolutely essential for problem solving. It's absolutely essential for creativity to disengage with the device, because the problem is, I don't know when it's going to happen. So I'd be like, well,
right.
I wasn't on my phone for a whole hour and I had no ideas. I know. I get it. And this is the problem. It has to be a repetitive behavior because we don't know when the inspiration strikes. So one of the things that I try to be good at is figuring out how I think, figuring out where my ideas come from and trying to repeat those things. So if my ideas are happening in showers, have longer showers.
Right, just, you know, wasting water like crazy, but it's good for business,
well,
right?
There's a difference between a 2-minute shower and a 5-minute shower,
yeah.
You know? It doesn't mean you're standing in there for an hour and a half, you know? When I was writing Leaders Eat Last, I would have so many ideas in the shower, or when I was brushing my teeth, for example, and I would forget them as quickly as I had them, that I kept a dry erase marker in my bathroom and I wrote on the tiles. And so as soon as I got out of the shower while I was brushing my teeth, I'd write an idea on the tile. And so when I was standing there the next day brushing my teeth, I'd be staring at my writing on the tile. And I'd sometimes have another idea. And so it looked like a beautiful mind. It was ridiculous. You know?
Yeah, I was going to say your bathroom.
My bathroom was covered. All the tiles had these little chicken scratches all over. And I didn't want to erase any of them because I didn't know what ideas were going to be sparked. But my point is like, if you figure out what works for you, do that. Keep a notebook by your bed. If you go for a run, take a notebook with you. I usually carry a notebook in the back of my pocket at all times because I don't know when I'm going to have an idea. And I, like I said, I lose them as quickly as I have them. And so the whole idea of disengaging and capturing the ideas is, I think, a big part of where ideas come from.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Simon Sinek. We'll be right back.
This episode is sponsored in part by 8 Sleep. We love our 8 Sleep. Jen turns up her side for the baby. I turn mine down because it's freaking hot in the house now because the baby's there, so the heat's always on. Every time you go online, you hear another ad for another mattress, but this is by far the best one. Jason and I were so excited for this. Jason, I know you use yours all the time.
Well, yeah, I sleep all the time, so I use it all the time. And it's great because I can have one side for the dogs that's just for them and one side for me. And I tell you what, having a 120-pound Rottweiler jump in and out of the bed all the time when I'm sleeping, I can't feel a thing. That mattress does not move. The heating and cooling is fantastic, but it also, the foam that it's made from, I cannot feel the dog jumping in and out of the bed. That is a fantastic side effect that I forgot to tell everybody about, like on the previous reads. But, you know, if your partner tosses and turns, you're probably going to sleep a hell of a lot better.
What I also love about 8 Sleep is it tracks your sleep as well. So they know, they're not just making sort of random claims. Customers who sleep on the pod, the 8 Sleep pod, fall asleep faster, toss and turn 25% less, have a 17% increase in periods of deep sleep, all in a crazy comfortable bed. So athletes are using it, trainers are using it, fancy pants models are using it, dorks like us are using it. Jason, tell them where they can get a deal on the pod.
Right now, you can get $150 off your pod and free shipping when you go to 8sleep.com/Jordan. That's 8sleep.com/Jordan, EIGHT sleep.com/Jordan for $150 off your pod with free shipping.
This episode is sponsored in part by Honey. I love this plugin. I installed it the other day. What it does is it knows what site you're on when you're shopping. And it's like, hey, do you want to try some coupon codes that you probably would Google and then give up after trying two that didn't work because there's 16 and it's only, you know, 10, 15, 20% off. So depending on what you're buying, well, Honey, what it does is it scours the web for promo codes, finds the best promo codes, applies them to the cart. So you just click go or whatever, and it just tries all the codes. So if you're on one of your favorite sites like Target, Best Buy, Sephora, Macy's, eBay, Etsy, Walmart, and even smaller sites too, it'll just try to apply all the coupons. You click apply coupons and boom, it scans the internet for these and you can see your price go down or get free shipping and stuff like that. Really, really handy. You save random amounts. Sometimes it's like $1.75, other times it's free shipping, and sometimes it's like, oh crap, I saved like 15% on this expensive thing from this promo code that I never would have even thought to look for. So it's really useful. 18 million members, $2 billion plus in savings, 30,000 online stores. So it's not just the big guys. And they're adding more every day. They've got 100,000 plus 5-star reviews on the Google Chrome store. It's a browser plugin for Chrome. Really easy to use. Not a lot of effort here. And it's free. Jason?
And the great part is Honey never sells your data. And not using Honey is literally passing up free money. It's free to use and installs in just 2 clicks. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/Jordan. That's joinhoney.com/Jordan and start saving today. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. And to learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard from our amazing sponsors, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget, we have a worksheet for today's episode, so you can make sure you solidify your understanding of the key takeaways from Simon Sinek. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. If you'd like some tips on how to subscribe to the show, just go to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. Subscribing to the show is absolutely free. It just means that you get all of the latest episodes downloaded automatically to your podcast player so you don't miss a single thing. And now back to our show with Simon Sinek.
There's something to this, of course, and there's science behind all of this.
Yes.
I'm wondering if the, is the 2 feet, 11 acres thing,
yeah,
is that something you just kind of like plucked, or is that, is there actually kind of a...
I heard it. That someone... I heard it from a reputable source.
Okay. That's good enough. That's good enough for now.
You know, I have a friend and I so envy him. He's so good at remembering. He's like, Yale conducted a study in 1974 by Dr. Rogers and Dr., you know, Smith. And they studied this, and what they discovered is that there's an 18 to 2 ratio, you know. And I'm like, they did a study, like, you know, they who do all the studies.
They, Google it, it might exist. Yeah.
You know, the numbers are about right.
Right.
That's me.
Yeah, yeah, that's, you know, and that should be good enough, although, yeah, now with everybody sort of making things up as we go along, it is more important to know that.
I do pride myself on the fact that I do actually go double check these things.
Sure, yeah.
And even though I can't remember the details, if I'm wrong, I'll immediately change it.
Oh, sure.
Because a couple of times I got a couple of things wrong and I immediately stopped, even though the wrong one really helped my argument.
Yeah.
And like, when you write a book, there's real rigor to writing a book, and I have to go find all the exact studies that I've been, you know, quoting approximately for years.
Sure.
So, yeah, I'm really envious of my friends who can remember every detail of these studies.
Speaking of friends that elevate our game, Worthy Rivals.
Yeah, I love that one.
It's so good,
so
right?
So good, isn't
because
it?
Because I feel like we all have these worthy rivals, sure, but sometimes we mistreat them. Can you go over the concept,
sure,
really briefly so people don't
remember? So James Carr's a philosopher who used to teach at NYU for many years. He's 87 now. He's an amazing guy. He theorized in 1986, he wrote a little book about these two types of games, finite games and infinite games. A finite game is defined as known players, fixed rules, and an agreed upon objective. Baseball, football. Mm-hmm. There's a beginning, middle, and end. The goal is to win, and if there's a winner, there has to be a loser, right? Then you have an infinite game. An infinite game is defined as known and unknown players. The rules are changeable, which means you can play however you want. There's mm-hmm. no referees. And the objective is to perpetuate the game, to stay in the game as long as possible. We are players in infinite games every day of our lives. These are games that have no finish line, mm-hmm. right? There's no agreed upon metrics. There's no agreed upon rules. There's no agreed upon timeframes. There's no such thing as winners and losers. Like, you can't be the winner in your marriage. You can definitely be
right.
the loser,
yeah.
but you cannot be the winner.
Yeah, good
right?
point.
There's no such thing as winning career. Like, no one is declared the winner of careers. There's no such thing as winning global politics, and there's no such thing as winning business. There's no winner of business, mm-hmm. right? But if we listen to people, they talk about being number one, being the best, and beating their competition. Based on what?
Right.
Well, we're number one, based on the metrics and the timeframes of your own choosing.
Yeah.
And even if you are number one, you're only number one for now, right?
It
doesn't last, right? Because it's an infinite game. There's no finish line.
Right.
The game just keeps going and going. And so when we view the other players as competitors, it's a finite mindset, because that means we want to beat them, because that's what competitors are for. I want to be the winner. I want them to be the loser,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is very unhealthy in games that have no finish lines, like
sure.
our careers, like in business, because what ends up happening is we look for shortcuts. Our perspective becomes shorter and shorter timeframes, and it ends up hurting trust, cooperation, and innovation.
Yeah, people will sacrifice their integrity to get ahead short term, but then it's like, well, you have to keep doing
it. Yeah, or you make a substandard product or mm-hmm. the rest of it. You know, and we see it play it out all the time. You know, we're seeing it playing out right now with Boeing, right? That was nothing short of short-term pressure that made them make some stupid decisions, right? They were obsessed with making their numbers rather than obsessed with making the safest airplane in the sky.
Terrifying,
right?
Yeah.
Right. No, it is terrifying,
yeah.
but that's how it plays out. And it's a whole series of events that take place, including ethical fading and all the rest of it, where pressure put on somebody, adding in unhealthy incentive structures, you end up with decisions being made all over the place that allow for this to happen. Leaders are responsible for that environment. The buck does stop somewhere, and that's at the top.
Is it the leader responsible for the environment, or is it like hashtag capitalism? Right?
No, it's not hashtag capitalism.
Okay.
That's absolutely nonsense. You know,
I agree.
There's nothing wrong with capitalism. There is something wrong with the form of capitalism that we practice now.
Mm-hmm.
Capitalism, as Adam Smith envisioned it, is the capitalism that Thomas Jefferson believed in, which is the capitalism that made America what it is today. It's only since about the 1970s that capitalism has become bastardized. Capitalism has always been about the people. It's always been about the consumer. It's only recently, since the late 1970s, a theory was proposed of shareholder supremacy, which was popularized in the 80s and 90s by people like Jack Welch, the CEO of GE. That's a new idea, shareholder supremacy. Adam Smith could never have imagined that. The idea of putting profit before a human being, that's a new idea.
Yeah.
The idea of using mass layoffs to balance the books on a regular basis didn't exist prior to the 1980s.
Really?
And all these didn't exist.
Huh.
So all of these insane ideas like Rankin Yank, where you promote the top 10% of performers and fire the bottom 10% every year, these are new ideas that were really popularized and promoted in the boom years of the 80s and 90s. So people are blaming capitalism, which is incorrect. It's this form of capitalism that I think is the problem. And the champions of this form of capitalism, like Jack Welch and his disciples, that is the problem. But capitalism isn't the problem, it's the form of capitalism. So the concept of, you know, viewing other companies or other individuals as competitors is really unhealthy. I mean, if you have a competitor at work, that means you will undermine them so that you can improve your sales numbers so you can get the bonus. Like, that's insane. You work for the same organization. And some companies, some leaders actually promote internal competition,
for sure,
which is really bad for the organization. So I like the term rival. And some of the rivals are worthy of comparison. They're worthy rivals. And a worthy rival is another player in the game whose strengths reveal to you your weaknesses, right? In other words, they're really good at something that makes you so uncomfortable, sometimes even angry, that you want to beat them, that you hate them sometimes. You have visceral responses. But in reality, it's because they're revealing something uncomfortable, and it's easier to take that uncomfortable energy and direct it at them rather than looking at yourself. Mm-hmm. We've all had the experience where somebody we worked with at work got a promotion and we got mad.
Yeah.
Think about that for a second. We're getting angry at somebody else's good fortune. What is it about that person that is touching a nerve inside us, right? That's a worthy rival. And the whole point of worthy rivalry is to recognize these people. You don't have to like them. You don't have to agree with them, but you have to respect them. To recognize these other people or organizations, because their strengths reveal to us our weaknesses, and our opportunity is to look at our weaknesses and build on them, mm-hmm. to work on them. In other words, it's a self-improvement exercise as individuals or as organizations, you know, and there are always other players in the game who are better than you. Always.
Well, yeah, ideally. Otherwise, you're really wasting your time.
And you, because you get to pick your own worthy rivals, if you just pick people that you constantly outperform, well, then you're going to get caught totally by surprise because someone will come and swoop in. So I love this idea of the worthy rival. And you asked at the top of the show about, you know, the other, am I competitive with some of the other remarkable
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Folks out there. And we were talking about Ken Robinson. And the answer is no, I learned from them. If I had a finite mindset, I'd want to compete with them. I want to get more gigs than them. I want to get higher profile gigs than them. I want to do more TED Talks. I want more views. Based on what? You know, I can be all high and mighty about myself because I got more Instagram followers than they do. Well, they got four times more Twitter followers than I do. Like, what's the correct metric?
Right.
It's ridiculous. The whole thing is a fool's errand. You just drive yourself nuts, right? And you can either make yourself feel proud because you only look at the ones where you're ahead, or you make yourself depressed because you only look at the ones that you're behind. And the answer is, it doesn't matter. Which is, what are they doing that's better than you, that you have an opportunity to push your own game, to advance yourself? It's self-improvement. So I would much rather view the other players in the game as worthy rivals rather than competitors.
That makes sense. I noticed that in the book you mentioned, we can select these people strategically. And that, I think, is simple, but most people don't do that. They just kind of look at whoever's in their orbit or whoever sits next to them in the office or whoever's getting accolades that day. And that's really unhealthy because if I'm just looking at whoever is showing up in my Instagram feed, it's a constant ass kicking that I'm giving myself.
Well, right. Not only that, we don't know how they're doing it, right? I know for a fact, because I get to see behind the scenes, that there are people who game the Amazon and New York Times bestseller list.
For sure.
Right? You can pay for a company to make you a New York Times bestseller. And if you look at the numbers behind the scenes, you can see the ones who are doing it. I know some of the names. I'm not going to say a word.
Right, of course. Right? Yeah. I would. It's not that kind of show.
Amazon, you know, the number of emails I get that say, hey, everybody, can you all please buy my book at the same time? Because Amazon calculates it, I think, hourly. And so if you get all your friends to buy your book in the same hour, you can become number one in a category.
And then you screenshot it, go home.
And then for the rest of time, you're an Amazon number one bestseller, you know? Or you get all your friends to write fake reviews to drive your stars up. Because more stars means more book sales. There's millions of ways to game the system. And so if I'm comparing myself to people who are gaming the system, so I'm getting all insecure because I think that they're better than me, but they're built on a house of cards anyway.
Right. They're better than you at emailing all their friends at the same time or whatever.
So you have to be a little bit cynical even when you make the comparisons, which is we don't actually know how people achieve their success. You know, the ones that I admire are the ones that I legitimately like them. Like I admire their work. I admire their message. But there's a consistency. Like they're able to do it on a regular basis. And when you meet them in person, when you see them on a stage, like they show up as exactly how you see them on a video or something. And there's an authenticity to it. Those are the ones I really choose to make myself a worthy rival with. Those are the ones I choose to compare my craft with their craft. And they're the ones who push me to be a better version of whatever I'm doing.
For people watching and listening, how do we select worthy rivals in a healthy way? You kind of touched on this, but I would love some sort of prescriptive if you
can. You know, my rule of thumb is the ones that make you uncomfortable. Like you hear their name and you go, you know, or somebody mentions the other company and you go, well, let me tell you the truth. You know, we sort of, you know, let me tell you how they do it.
Right.
You know, if there's an emotional response, it's probably touching a nerve for a reason. Sometimes it's because they're worthy rivals. Not always. But I think that's a good rule of thumb.
There's an introspection to be had here because there's definitely people where I go, all right, this person's a worthy rival because they show me that I should be reaching out for bigger names or better equipment.
Oh, no, that's not it. That's not how Worthy Rivals. Worthy Rivalry isn't, you don't pick Worthy Rivals because their numbers are better than yours. That's the finite mindset because we're comparing metric to metric.
Right.
Right? And they're arbitrary selections. No. A Worthy Rival we compare because their marketing is better than ours or they're the gold standard. Like if you're in the airline business, Southwest Airlines should definitely be one of your Worthy Rivals because everybody talks about and writes about Southwest Airlines. You'd be insane to ignore that they're doing something right. You don't have to do it the way that they do it, but you have to pay attention that they're doing something. You have to learn from them. If you're in the smartphone business, you know, we cannot ignore the iPhone. You just can't ignore it. Now, is it as incredible as it used to be? That's debatable. But what got us here,
right,
there's something pretty remarkable about that. You know, Netflix, if you're in the TV or movie business, you have to be looking at Netflix. Not by their numbers or their market caps or anything like this, but there's something that they're doing that made them the gold standard. There's something that they're doing that everybody uses them as the benchmark. They should definitely be a Worthy Rival.
So you're not looking at metrics, and it's so easy to get sucked into the metrics, right?
Correct.
It's so easy to go, Tim Ferriss has a million downloads per episode. I guess it's possible, and that's great to get a little bit of like a expand your horizons and see what's a possibility for you. What the market could possibly bear or whatever it is. But that's kind of where that has to end. Because if you're just chasing the same number of subscribers, you're going to drive yourself crazy.
Also, isn't it better to have loyal subscribers rather than lots of subscribers?
For sure, yeah.
You know, it's like profit versus revenue.
Yeah.
You know, our revenues are, yeah, but you're losing money hand over fist. And the problem is when you have truly visionary companies like Amazon, where they were able to lose money over the course of time because there was something bigger at play that Bezos understood. And so now that's used as the reason we should sustain all money-losing companies.
Right.
You know? Well, Amazon lost money for, you know, it's like, yes. Tesla loses. Yes. But there's a much bigger vision at play that is not about their metrics, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be very careful in those kinds of comparisons. So when you're talking about, it's the same thing. It's like, I'd rather a company be small and profitable than big and losing money.
You speak at a lot of companies and you talk with, I assume, the head honchos at a lot of these companies. Some of them, Amazon, Tesla, those are obvious winners. What are some of the sort of silent killers where you're like, wow, these people really have it figured out, but nobody's really talking about them, or they're so small, but wait 5 years? Because you have an inside look at a lot of these places.
I've written about some of them. I mean, I think that Barry Waymiller, run by a guy named Bob Chapman, is an absolutely remarkable company. And what I like is, you know, I've had the opportunity to really get to know Bob, and he's become a dear friend and mentor. He's written his own book. The foreword, by the way, is fantastic.
I assume you wrote it.
I did.
Yeah.
If you read nothing else, just read the foreword.
Just read the foreword. And then place it back on the shelf.
Joking aside, I mean, Bob, his company is one of those companies that we should be learning from. But nobody really, it's a funny name company, Barry Waymiller. We don't really know even how to spell it, you know. But his work is really important. And I'm glad that people now know more about who he is and know about his company. There's a lot of companies that just do well that we know are good, but we don't study them enough. What Kip Tindle built over at Container Store is very, very special.
That, from your book, was so surprising. Because when I think of like businesses that seem incredibly boring, it's the Container Store. And whenever my wife's like, I'm going to go to the Container Store and get shelves for the garage, I'm just like, I'm going to go to the dentist and get a root canal.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to go to the Container Store.
You just revealed that you're not an organized person.
Clearly, I am.
Because organized people, like... You know,
they love the Container Store.
That is like their...
That's why I married Jen. She loves the Container Store.
Yeah.
It's a good match.
It is a good match. So, yeah. No, I know many people who Container Store is like,
it's their thing,
It's their utopia.
For me,
their Shangri-La.
The Container Store, though, such an interesting example. You wrote about this in Infinite Game where, well, why don't you tell it better? They basically hit the recession after growing 20% year-on-year.
It's a very... The reason I admire Kip Tindle and what he did is what happened cannot be reproduced overnight. It takes years to achieve what he achieved, which is when the recession hit, after, as you said, 20% compounded growth over the course of 30 years, all of a sudden, like everything plummeted by 13%, and they weren't used to that. And so, like many companies, they looked into cost cutting because they had to, you know, get through these rough times. But they did not lay off a single human being. They did not look to layoffs as the means to cost cut. But what they did do is they went around the company and said, okay, here's what's going to happen. Like, we need to tighten the belts. And they had some ideas. And spontaneously, people started taking it upon themselves to find more opportunities.
That was shocking.
I know. And so, for example, some of them would take business trips and not submit their expense reports. They downgraded their hotels voluntarily. They were not told to do it. So they'd stay at an economy hotel versus a luxury hotel, or not luxury, but a nice hotel. And they even called vendors and said, can you help us out? we need to cut costs. And the vendor said, sure.
Right.
Which is unheard of.
Right.
Why should your vendors cut their costs to help you save your money? It doesn't make any sense. And it's because of years and years and years of looking after their employees that their employees wanted to look after the company. It's after years and years and years of treating their vendors with respect that the vendors wanted to pay back. And it's a very human thing. They couldn't have done anything. There's no company that could have instructed their employees to downgrade their hotels or pay their own expenses on business trips. Right? And even if people were forced to do it, the rumblings underneath would be furious. Oh, and then as soon as times got better, the people would look for ways to steal it back.
Sure.
Right? Even if they were stealing office supplies, they would rationalize it. Well, like, they're forcing me. I'm going to take from them.
Yeah.
But there was this amazing sense of camaraderie and pride. Like, we're going to figure this out together. And again, it's because they didn't use mass layoffs either. They said, we're not going to sacrifice you to save this company, but we're all going to have to find ways. And because it was spontaneous, it worked. And again, you couldn't do it overnight. Think of it like friendship, right? Mm-hmm. Friendship is not a balanced equation. Nobody keeps a notebook of like all the things that I've done for you and all the things you've done for me. It's like, well, I did 13 things for you last month, and you've only done 4 for me this month. Like, this friendship is not fair.
Yeah.
It's not how friendship works.
Right.
Friendship is about equitable, not equal. The way I like to define equitable versus equal. Equal is I do the dishes, you do the dishes. I cook, you cook. I take out the garbage, you take out the garbage. That's equal.
Mm-hmm.
Equitable is I'll cook, you do the dishes. I'll put the kids to bed, you take out the garbage. Like, it's equitable, not equal. We're not doing the same things, but we both feel like we're contributing. We both feel like it's balanced,
mm-hmm.
right? And the same goes in a company. They're equitable relationships, which is we take care of the people. It's like in friendship, as I was saying, a friendship is not about equal number of things we do for each other. I could do 50 things for you and you do nothing for me. But the reason I consider you a friend is because I have absolute confidence that the one time
right.
I'm going to need something, I know you'll be there for me no matter what. Even if I never call it in.
Right.
It's the confidence that you will. And that's what makes the friendship equitable. That's what makes the friendship good and balanced. And it's the same in a company, which is when we take care of our people over and over and over again, even though we may never ask them to sacrifice, if it ever came to the point where we do, they will. Because it's equitable, because we've been taking care of them, and we know that they'll be there for us, right? This is why a lot of companies, you know, they expect, you know, in hard times to just ask people to sacrifice and expect it to go well, and it won't, because you haven't been looking after the people for the past 5 years, 6 years, 10 years, when times were good.
Right.
Right? So Kip Tindall's a very important CEO and founder of a company in the world today. He was also very satisfied with being extremely profitable, but not necessarily being the biggest. Container Store is a relatively small company compared to a lot of other companies, but very profitable, very well run, very loyal employees, very stable. And so Kip always talked about how he'd rather have that than more revenues, than arbitrary size, you know, open thousands of stores mm-hmm. that don't make money just to say that you have more stores than everybody else.
It's funny how this shows up everywhere inside the business too. Jen, my wife, loves going to the Container Store because she'll go during their one or two sales by these, I don't know, Italian Elfa, whatever, shelving.
Swedish.
Is Elfa Swedish?
Mm-hmm.
So they'll buy these things. They're amazing. And then she'll go, uh-oh, I bought the wrong thing or I bought too many. And then she's like, and then I got really busy and then we flew to wherever and I didn't return them. And she'll call and they'll be like, it's fine. Mm-hmm. Just bring them back. And then the guy from the store will like help unload the car, which is probably against every insurance regulation mm-hmm. that they have. But it's a nice thing to do when you're 8 months pregnant.
And the reason that works is because the Container Store trusts their employees to use their own discretion,
mm-hmm.
right? Poorly led organizations, people say things to you, I'm not allowed to do that, it's against the rules,
or right.
I'm not allowed to do that, I'll get in trouble. Like, you're 8 months pregnant and you got a heavy thing, like, I'd love to yeah. help you, but I can't, I'll get in trouble.
Right.
That's a poorly led organization. A yeah. well-led organization, they know what the rules are. We don't trust people to follow the rules. We trust people to know when to break the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And we hire good people and we take care of them and we build up their confidence and they know the rules. But there's always an opportunity to break the rules because it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I'll give you an example. Both of these stories are true. They're unrelated, but they're both true. In the U.S. Air Force, we have a very simple rule. Don't fly into Iranian airspace. Really simple.
Yeah.
There was a KC-135 tanker that was in the region, and they accidentally drifted into Iranian airspace. Completely unrelated, completely separate incident. There was another KC-135 tanker that was in the airspace, and a fighter jet called Bingo, which means he ran out of gas. And so they needed to get to him to refuel him in in-flight refueling. And they made the decision that the quickest way to get to him was to just slice through a little corner of Iranian airspace. And the crew made the choice, knowing that they could get in trouble, because it broke the rules, mm-hmm. to slice through the Iranians' airspace, right? Now, if we treated everybody the same just based on the rule book, both of those crews would have been punished, which later on produces some serious problems, because then if there's another crew and there's a plane in trouble, will they be too afraid for fear of getting in trouble to cut through Iranian airspace? Now, in real life, what happened is only one of those crews got in trouble, which is the idiots who drifted into Iranian airspace, right? Hmm. But the crews who made the choice to break the rules because it was the right thing to do to get to a pilot who was out of gas, that's what I'm talking about. That's discretion. We trust people to make their decisions, and we trust people not to follow the rules. We trust people to know when the right time to break them. So yes, for insurance reasons, we can't help everybody take all their stuff, curbside, whatever it is. But if there's someone pregnant and there's something heavy, you know what? I'm going to break this rule.
Yeah.
Because it's the right thing to
do. It's the right thing to do.
And a good leader will look at that and understand their intentions and may not agree, but say, I understand and it's fine, right? But you're doing it for everyone. Now you have an insurance problem. Again, we don't trust people to follow rules. We trust people to know when to break them. And that's called discretion. And the best organizations give their frontline employees the discretion to make decisions. The founder of the Ritz-Carlton said, my lowest paid employees have all the contact with my customer. So if you're not treating these frontline people well and you're not giving them discretion, you have a terrible, terrible brand, no matter how great your executive ranks are. And we've seen this 1,000 times. We've all had really bad experiences. There are even companies that we quote unquote don't like because of our experience with them. But if you meet their leadership's wonderful.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
Except for the fact that it's not filtering down. It happens on a regular basis. So it's a reason to admire Container Store.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Simon Sinek. We'll be right back after this.
This episode is sponsored in part by Heineken 00. Heineken 00 is an alcohol-free beer. You can enjoy it wherever you want. Well, theoretically, anytime, anywhere. But let's be real. There are definitely some places you shouldn't have beer, whether it has alcohol or not. But unlike many non-alcoholic beers, Heineken 00 is completely alcohol-free at 0.0%, and it still tastes like Heineken. Under 70 calories per can, good choice if you want to skip the alcohol but still enjoy a beer. And January, as we all know, time for those resolutions to be made, and for many of us, already broken. But for people like me, that means no alcohol for a month. If you're doing Dry January, check out JanuaryDryPack.com. That's JanuaryDryPack.com. You can get a coupon for $3 off your next purchase of Heineken 00 and skip the booze this January. Let me know what you think. This episode is also sponsored by Lightstream. So the holidays are over, it's a brand new year, and a lot of people have been dreading their bills that are on the way. And I always wondered why people didn't do more of this, but you can pay off your credit card balances and you can save a bunch of money with credit card consolidation loans. Lightstream is a great provider of this. You can roll multiple credit card payments into one payment at a lower fixed rate. So most credit cards are like 11, 12, 14, 20%. Lightstream's credit card consolidation loans have rates that are as low as 5.95% APR with autopay. So there's no fees on these. There's no application fees. There's no origination fees. There's no transaction fees. There's no prepayment penalties. That's important because, you know, if you get money or a bonus from your job or a gift from somebody, you don't want to go and throw that towards your debt and then find out you got some stupid fee for that. They're not doing that at Lightstream. I made sure of that because I wanted to approve something that was good in terms of advertising for the show. And you can apply right from your phone as well. So it's not this complicated, annoying-ass process. And frankly, if you're paying a credit card balance and you're not going to pay it off in 1 month and you're paying 20%, 10%, whatever, more APR, you should consolidate these always, because your credit card companies are merciless with the interest. That's how they make their money. And you shouldn't let them get away with that. Jason?
Just for our listeners, apply now and get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/Jordan. That's LIGHTSTREAM.com/Jordan and get that special interest rate discount. Subject to credit approval. Rate includes a 0.5% auto-pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/Jordan for more information.
This episode is also sponsored in part by BetterHelp. Online counseling, I talk about it every Friday especially, but I'm a huge fan of therapy. I'm a big fan of BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, anger, trauma, family stuff, grief stuff, self-esteem stuff. A lot of times younger people, or older people for that matter, coming out of the closet with the LGBT stuff, that can be massively stressful and kind of encompasses all of the other things, sleep, trauma, anger, family, and relationships. So humans are complicated. Look, there's no shame in getting therapy. I think the most sane people are the ones that work hard to maintain their sanity. It's just like people who are athletic. They go to the gym, they work out. It's very rarely just naturally their state. BetterHelp's here to help you maintain or regain your sanity. You can connect with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. So everything's confidential. Everything is convenient. No driving. Scheduling's easy. You can get help at your own time, at your own pace. Secure video or just phone sessions. Plus, you can chat and text with your therapist. And you can switch therapists at any time. It's really easy. It's convenient. And I'm a huge fan because it takes the friction out of finding a therapist, driving across town, scheduling, etc. This is the way to go. Dip your toes in those therapy waters and get your sanity back here in 2020. Jason?
It's a truly affordable option for our listeners, and you can get 10% off your first month with discount code Jordan. So get started today. Go to betterhelp.com/Jordan. Simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/Jordan. Thank you for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers keeps us going. To learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard so you can check out those amazing sponsors for yourself, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget that worksheet for today's episode. The link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. If you're listening to us on the Overcast player, please click that little star next to the episode. We really appreciate it. And now for the conclusion of our episode with Simon Sinek.
I think you can really see this in businesses that are run well. And it's hard to say if it's something like Apple where, you know, it can be hit or miss, but usually you walk in there and the people at the retail locations, it's Thanksgiving rush. Everyone should theoretically be miserable and angry and they almost can't wait to help you. Well, once you break them out of their little click conversations or whatever, they're kind of excited to show you something in the photo app. And you're just like, how on earth do you build fans among your employees that are so interested in helping somebody on Black Friday?
Angela Ahrendts, who was the head of Apple Retail until recently, gets a lot of the credit for that. And she was the former CEO of Burberry as well, who was responsible for the big Burberry turnaround. They offered all kinds of benefits to the frontline employees. If you were a full-time retail employee, you got stock option opportunities like HQ employees. You got the same healthcare benefits as HQ employees. You got $2,500 in outside education opportunity, which the company would reimburse you for.
Wow.
You know, all these amazing perks that are usually reserved for folks who work at headquarters. But these are frontline, full-time retail employees that usually are treated differently.
Yeah.
And her attitude was, they're full-time employees. We should treat them like all full-time employees. So they gave them all the same benefits. So, of course, the first thing that goes through people's mind is, that must cost, we couldn't do that. It costs a fortune.
No wonder my iPhone is so expensive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So Angela actually ran the numbers. What she discovered is that the cost to take care of these people was net zero because it was offset by the savings, as because they had so little turnover, they had a much smaller recruiting department because they weren't constantly hiring new frontline retail people.
And training them.
And training them.
And losing productivity.
And most shoplifting happens by employees.
Oh, that makes sense.
The numbers that I've heard are astonishing, that the average retail store suffers 10% losses from shoplifting, most of which is by employees.
Wow.
I know, it's astonishing. But if you look at the best led organizations, they suffer like 2 and 3% shoplifting numbers. Like they're much, much lower because people just, you take care of me, we take care of you. And so what Angela found out was the reduced recruiting costs, not to mention the fact that it's hard to train somebody up every single few months to get the kind of quality and knowledge. Basically, the net spend was zero, right? Was zero. And so when other companies say we can't afford to do that, and by the way, this is not just because Apple's a high-priced retailer, you know.
I was going to ask about that.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, Costco does the exact same thing. Costco takes care of their frontline employees extremely well, and their net expense on that is also zero.
Wow.
Because of the additional savings on the back end. Not to mention, a number which you cannot calculate, is just the improved quality of customer service, you know, that plays to customer loyalty and all the rest of it. Here we are singing the praises of Apple and Costco simply because of their employee treatment. You know, the way they treat employees. Because I can tell you some terrible stories of companies as well. And you and I go on the air and tell terrible stories as well. those are numbers that are hard to calculate.
Yeah. And I would imagine that a lot of executives who are thinking in finite terms, playing finite games, they're reporting, well, we're going to lose money, but if we lay off 3,000 people, it looks like we made a profit. And then they just don't necessarily on the back end go, crap, we got to rehire 3,000 people in the next 2 years.
I'll tell you one of my favorite stories. I was flying Air Canada. I was flying from Toronto to New York. It's a short flight. It's like a 40-minute flight. Customs is on that side. And so you have to get to the airport really early because who knows how long the lines will be at customs. And so we got there super early and went really quickly. And we got through really quickly. And we were there early enough to get on the earlier flight. So I went up to the gate agent and said, hey, I got here early. Do you have any seats on the earlier flight so I can get back home earlier? And she said, yeah, we do. I said, fantastic. Mm-hmm. Can we get on this plane? And she went like this and said, yes, it'll cost $500 each. I was like, look, whether you put me on the plane or you not put me on the plane, I'm not paying $500 to get on a flight 1 hour earlier for a 40-minute flight. Like, it's never going to happen.
That's ridiculous, yeah.
It's going to the same airport. Like, I'm not changing my route, not changing anything. I just got here early. You have empty seats. Can I please get on it? Right. By the way, this is something that every airline in the world will do.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And she said, well, we have to charge you. I said, just so I understand, you are okay sending two empty seats back to New York because you're so intent on making this $500 a ticket, which I'm not paying. I'd rather just wait. Right? So you're not going to get the money. But either way, you're not getting the money, right? So you're okay knowing that you won't get the money, sending two empty seats back instead of making a customer happy. And she leaned forward and said, sir, this is a business. What hit me is that didn't come from her.
No.
No frontline employee is going to lean into a customer and be like, sir, this is a business. That came from her manager. And her manager was told that. And that manager was told that, and that manager was told that. So all the way through the line, people were trying to do the right thing, and somebody stopped them from doing the right thing.
Right.
And were told, this is a business. That trickled down from up on high, right? That did not come from her.
No, of course not. She doesn't care. She has no dog in
that. And now look what's happening. Not only did they not get my $500 because I waited my hour, but here I am talking about...
We're trashing Air Canada.
Terrible customer service on Air Canada.
And it's Canada. That's double worse.
So now, I don't know if they've changed their policy since. This was a few years ago. I don't believe they have.
No, why would they?
And I believe you need like executive status to like get on a flight early or something.
Yeah.
But my point is, it's okay to have the rule there. It's okay to charge the fee and all of this. And you know, I don't have an issue with that. It's that this employee had no discretion to break the rule because she decided this is the right thing to do to take care of a customer, and the seats are empty anyway, right? She had no discretion. She felt she had no discretion, and that's the problem. Because everybody knows the right thing to do. You don't. It doesn't require excessive amounts of training to know this is fair and that's unfair.
Right.
Right? This is a leadership problem, not an employee problem. I do not blame her, right? I blame her manager and her manager's manager and her manager's manager manager and however many managers I can go up the chain of command in the hierarchy that somebody denied their employees the discretion to do the job they've been trained to do.
There's all these...
And we suffer.
Right.
The company suffers.
Sure.
And the employee suffers.
She probably goes home and goes...
Yeah, she doesn't like her job.
I have to friggin' deal with this.
I guarantee you she doesn't like her job. The reason employees really want to take care of us is because usually those employees really feel taken care of.
Sure.
And it's the same companies. The companies that we celebrate the way they treat their employees tend to have remarkably good customer service. Mm-hmm. Costco, Southwest Airlines, Container Store, they tend to have amazing customer service, not because they train people how to do amazing customer service. It's because they look after their people and their people are happy to look after us. It's not a complicated formula.
Man, it burns to hear that because it seems so simple. Look, I'm not an upper management at Air Canada. However, looking at Southwest and having the people at the check-in gate doing their little wrap, they didn't go, okay, it's Friday, so you can wrap the safety rules if you want to. Right? It's not office space.
No.
They just go...
Do what you want.
Do what you want as long as it sort of complies with
the
FAA.
Well, the FAA rules are is that you have to do it and you have to be able to understand it.
Sure.
Be legible or whatever the audio audio version
of legible is. Yeah, I was trying to...
Articulate, I don't know what it is. Anyway.
Intelligible.
Intelligible, thank you. You have to do it and it has to be intelligible, but the FAA does not instruct how you do it. And so Southwest requires their people to do it. They take it upon themselves and how they do it. And it makes us all actually listen.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us don't look up or take our headphones out for the safety announcement. Worse, the number of employees that push a recording. So really zoned. It's not even a human being talking to us. It's a recording, right? Which is the most impersonal thing in the world. My favorite one is, you know, a recording that comes on that says, ladies and gentlemen, please put your seatbelts on. A recording, like for every nervous flyer out there, there's nothing more beautiful than a really relaxed captain coming on going, ladies and gentlemen, from the flight deck, a little bit of chop for the next 10 minutes. Nothing dangerous. If you just put your seatbelts up on, please, and we'll be out of this in 10 minutes. I mean, amazing. Yeah. Versus a recording that comes on and says, seatbelts, you know? Yeah.
Strap yourself in, you might die.
And the point is, it's nothing to do with good, bad, right, wrong. It's that one is personal and one is impersonal. And when we treat people like human beings, the whole process becomes human. When we treat people like robots or like numbers, the whole process becomes inhuman. And in this day and age, humanity is something we're struggling to find. You know, deep, meaningful relationships seem to become more and more elusive. And just human connection becomes so wonderful and so valuable that we can build it into other places. We can build it in. Why is it that you have to be an elite passenger or a gold platinum customer with a bank that when you call a customer service number, a human being picks up?
Right.
Nobody wants to listen to a recording. We all hit 00000 anyway.
Yeah.
Like when did talking to a human being become a status or a luxury? That should be the basic. And they do it because they save money. They save money, and at the same time, they actually are creating burden. You know, I'm okay with the electronic stuff for really basic stuff. Is my flight on time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of us go online to change our seats. But I think a lot of the time for a lot of people, when we call, it's because we can't do it online. Like, we're stuck.
We're stuck.
You know, that's why I'm calling. Or there's something unusual. Or I need some advice to work this through. So I think the organizations that really understand that connecting somebody with a human being, even though there might be an additional cost on the call center side, pays dividends on the back end.
Which company or organization do you think is exhibiting finite thinking instead of playing an infinite game, and whose reckoning is on the horizon? And I'm worried you're going to say the United States, but,
well, I mean,
you know.
Organizations go in and out of it, you know? And especially when there's succession, when there's different leaders, mm-hmm. right? And so because some leaders are more infinite and some leaders are more finite. And if an organization is rich, it can usually sustain a finite leader for a period of time. But hopefully, successive leaders will be infinite. Otherwise, that organization will eventually go out of business. So there have been organizations that have gone in and out of it. So Walmart's a great example. Walmart definitely was infinite when Sam Walton ran it. And a couple of the CEOs who followed after Sam Walton definitely were infinite-minded, trying to advance the cause of the common average American, you know, working American.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had a guy by the name of Mike Duke, who was the previous CEO, not the current CEO, who was much more finite-driven, much more numbers-driven, cared much more about short-term results, cared much more about lining his pockets than taking care of his people. And Walmart suffered as a result. We used to rally for Walmart and love Walmart. Then we started hating Walmart and wanting them out of our neighborhoods. And the company might have done okay in the short term, but it did a lot of long-term damage to the employee and to the customer, which really made the company much harder to run. Doug McMillon came in. He's the new CEO. He's way more infinite-minded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, under Steve Ballmer, Microsoft, which was an infinite-minded company for many years under Gates, really became very excessively focused on short-term results and financial results, trying to beat Apple,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to just trying to be the best version of themselves and advance their cause of helping people be more productive. Satya Nadella, the new CEO at Microsoft, is way more infinite-minded. So the good news is those companies had a lot of money to sustain through a finite-minded period. Some organizations are not as lucky. I mean, Lehman Brothers is a great example.
Oh, yeah.
They went bankrupt, lickety-split.
Yeah.
And a lot of those companies that sort of hit the skids pretty early, pretty quickly, rather. You know, the companies go in and out of it. And I think a lot of the companies that we struggle with, we have problems with their ethical decisions. Odds are very high that they've become very finite-minded. Usually companies that we question their ethics. And I don't mean every company has ethical lapses, but when it becomes a recurring theme, you know, Facebook is a prime example.
I was just going to ask about Facebook,
You know, they were an infinite-minded company when they started, and Zuckerberg really had every opportunity to become one of the great leaders in American business today. And I don't know what happened. The company became more obsessed with its business model than it did with advancing a cause. It uses its cause to justify decisions rather than looking for ways. And they seem more protective of their business model. And so all of these questionable ethical decisions they make over and over and over again, it's not one ethical lapse. It's a series of ethical lapses. It seems that the company has just really become much more finite focused, which is a real shame. Can it come out of it? Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. Like any individual. I know many leaders who were very finite minded and they became Bob Chapman, who I now rave about. He was one of those finite-minded leaders for many, many years, and he had an epiphany, and he became pretty remarkable. He's become a pretty remarkable leader as a result of that transformation. I yearn for these leaders to refine that infinite vision that helped them build their companies into what they are today and go back to that, even if it means struggling in the short term to get there or to find a business, new business model. It'll make the company more sustainable in the long term beyond the lifespan of all of these founder leaders.
I think a lot of people think, I can't do that or our company can't do that because it'll hurt profit. And then you look at somebody like The Container Store or Patagonia who says, we're going to investigate all the labor and the people that make the jackets. And then suddenly your friends are shaming you for wearing the other brand that has, I don't know, human trafficking as part of the process.
Yeah. And the answer is, let's not kid ourselves. Yeah, it will hurt profit in the short term. But over the long term, it's the right thing to do. You know, it's like going to the gym. Well, it hurts. When you start going to the gym, it really, really hurts and you don't see results for a while.
Yeah.
But you kind of have to stick with it and it's the right thing to do. It's the same thing. You know, yes, it's going to hurt. And yes, there's going to be struggle. But if you've been taking care of your people, the people will hunker down and go through the hard times with you because it's the right thing to do. You know, Kodak is one of the prime examples of an organization that couldn't change their business model. You know, they invented the digital camera in 1975.
A lot of people don't notice that.
Kodak invented the digital camera. But they were too worried that the digital camera would steal market share from film sales,
right,
which they were a film, chemical, and paper company, that they literally suppressed the technology. And they made billions of dollars, not millions, billions of dollars from the royalties they got from the patents they owned. So other companies were actually using Kodak technology as the digital revolution started to show up. So your Nikons and your Fujis were actually using Kodak technology. And when those patents ran out, 5 years later, Kodak was bankrupt. Right?
It's mind-blowing that that can
happen. And yet on paper, Wall Street was hailing them as healthy and good and strong just because the income sheet looked good. But it was built on a questionable foundations, right? What would have been more responsible and very difficult was to transform the company into a digital company, knowing that the end of paper and chemicals and developing was nigh and end of film was nigh. Mm-hmm. And it absolutely would have hurt profits and it absolutely would have hurt revenues and it absolutely would have put the company through a short-term stress. But they would have done it and Kodak may have been the digital company today where we would be demanding the phone that had the Kodak technology. Like, we just don't know. But that would have been the right thing to do. Instead, they went bankrupt. You got to be kidding me.
Unbelievable.
And the worst part is every single one of those executives that made those decisions had long retired when Kodak went bankrupt, which means that all of them got their fat bonuses because the company was making tons of money
right.
and literally left the company in a shambles after they left and bared no responsibility and bared no consequences because of it.
And that's finite thinking. And it's scary when you extrapolate that out to current world politics or any sort of like macroeconomic decision. And you go, wait a minute, aren't we doing that in a lot of areas?
We look for the short-term gains because there's political advantages, just like we look for short-term gains because it helps me get my bonus at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. But there are long-term consequences. There's a cost for every decision we make. And I think people forget that. Sometimes the cost comes in money, and sometimes the cost comes in other things. But there's a cost for every decision we make, and not all the costs are worth the money we make.
Simon, thank you. This is interesting as expected.
Thank you, Jordan. Good to see you.
Thanks to Simon for popping by the studio today. Always good to see you, man. The book, the new book, is called The Infinite Game. All his books are good. They're a good read. We'll link to those in the show notes. Highly recommend you pick those up. And by the way, when you buy books through our website, you do support the show. We didn't have the little affiliate links up before, but now we do, because, you know, I'm buying diapers these days, folks, and those things ain't cheap. But no, really, we actually do really appreciate that. We put the money towards improving things like transcripts. The reason we have transcripts, which are typically ROI negative for us, are because of those affiliate links. So if you're digging the show, you're digging the transcripts and the work that's put into the website, please do shop Amazon through us and through those links on the site. That really does add up with all y'all. And I'm not just going and eating fine sushi with it. I'm reinvesting it in the show. Otherwise, you know, it's tempting sometimes to just not even have the site and just do the show. I'd save so much money. But I know you guys use those things and those resources. So I do appreciate when you use them. There's a video of this interview, by the way, speaking of things that your purchases pay for. There's a video on our YouTube channel at jordanharbinger.com/YouTube. Also in the show notes, worksheets for every episode, including everything you've learned here from Simon Sinek, or almost everything. You can review that by checking out the worksheet linked in the show notes. We also have transcripts for every episode, as I just mentioned. Those are also in the show notes as well. I'm teaching you how to connect with great people and manage relationships using systems, using tiny habits, over at our 6-minute networking course, which is free at jordanharbinger.com/course. Don't do it later. Do it now. It takes 6 minutes a day. It actually takes 5, but that other domain was taken. What can I say? Dig the well before you get thirsty. You know how awkward it is to reach out to somebody when you need something and you haven't talked to them for a while? That's totally avoidable. That's completely up to you. Don't procrastinate. It'll let you stagnate. JordanHarbinger.com/course. The drills take a few minutes a day. I wish I knew this stuff 20 years ago. JordanHarbinger.com/course is where it is. It's free. There's no upsells. Don't worry. You don't need to put in your friggin' credit card. It's totally free. Just log in. I don't even need to know who you are. By the way, most of the guests on the show actually subscribe to the course and the newsletter, so come join us. You'll be in smart company where you belong. In fact, you can reach out to Simon, tell him you enjoyed this episode of the show. Show guests love hearing from you, and you never know what might shake out of that. Speaking of building relationships, you can always reach out and follow me on social. I'm Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. This show is created in association with Podcast One. This episode was produced by Jen Harbinger, Jason DeFilippo, and our engineer is Jace Sanderson. Show notes and worksheets by Robert Fogarty. Music by Evan Viola. I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. Our advice and opinions and those of our guests are their own. I'm a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer, and I would not recommend hiring me as your lawyer, even if I were. So do your own research before implementing anything you hear on the show. And remember, we rise by lifting others. The fee for the show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful or interesting. That should be in every episode, and for sure this one with Simon Sinek. Come on. So share the show with those you love and even those you don't. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen. We'll see you next time.